You're listening to the Bird Dog Babe podcast with my mom, Courtney Bastian.
This episode is presented to you by Purina Pro Plan and Boss Shot Shells.
So we're finding jobs for the dogs, and that's what I try to help people do, is figure out what can we fit within your lifestyle that's realistic, that this dog can get some sense of fulfillment doing what they, some similarity to what they naturally were meant to do. And that's the hardest process sometimes about being a pet dog trainer, is helping people understand your dog is not fulfilled sitting on the couch with you at night and taking a quick walk around the block, you know, in the morning. And it doesn't matter that he has a big yard and 30 toys. He is not fulfilled by that because he's built to do something else that has a purpose. So if you can't make him feel like he has a purpose, you know, I think any of us are going to go a little crazy if we don't have a purpose, and our dogs are going to express it in ways that are going to be very frustrating to us.
Hey, Bird Dog Babes. My name is Courtney Bastian, and I am obsessed with all things bird dogs. And I'm here to share with you the stories, experiences, knowledge, and opinions from the women and a few guys in the industry that are killing it. I'm a Wisconsin girl living in a Montana world, mom and two incredible kiddos, wife and occasional assistant to a pro gun dog trainer, traveling the U.S. talking about canine nutrition while hunting, raising, and competing with my German wire hair pointers and Brocchi Italiano. As someone who started hunting later in life because I wanted to give my dogs the opportunity to do what they were bred to do, I'm here to help inspire, educate, and connect women to get their bird dogs out in the field and experience a bond like no other. So pour yourself a glass of wine and get ready to be challenged and encouraged while you learn. This is the Bird Dog Babe Podcast. My guest today is Robin McFarland. Robin is the owner and training director of That's My Dog and also heads the That's My Dog E-Academy, a continuing ed program for dog training professionals. Robin's ability to read and understand dogs is unlike any I've ever seen. In this episode, she discusses the importance of choosing a breed that's right for your lifestyle and how that relates to dogs bred for a purpose. In addition, she gives tips on how we can better understand our dogs, help them overcome situations, and breaks down the proper use of remote collar training. It's crazy how and when people come into our lives. Shortly after I acquired my first bird dog, an Irish setter, while I was in college, I found the nearest dog trainer to start puppy and obedience classes, which is how I met Robin. I can't thank her enough for that foundation, which helped to ignite so much more. And I'm stoked about sharing this episode of this amazing woman with all of you. Watch for details this week for your chance to win the training videos mentioned in this episode from Gun Dog Supply, in addition to a training consultation with Robin herself. All right, let's get after it. This episode is presented to you by Purina Pro Plan. What makes a great bird dog is genetics, training, and nutrition, and that's why I trust and feed Purina Pro Plan. With over 500 nutritionists, veterinarians, and scientists on staff, Pro Plan delivers a full spectrum of performance and specialized dog food formulas to help bird dogs like yours excel at every stage of life. Purina supports us, the breeders, owners, and trainers, the events we compete in, our national breed clubs, canine health research, and our committed partners to conservation groups such as Pheasants Forever, Rough Grouse Society, and Ducks Unlimited. 95 out of the top 100 dogs are fueled by the advanced nutrition of Purina Pro Plan. This episode is also presented by Boss Shot Shells. Copper-plated bismuth Boss provides a better, more effective non-lead option than steel and are safe to use in Grandpa's gun. Available in 10, 12, 16, 20, 28-gauge, and 410, direct-to-consumer pricing and cases shipped right to your door. Shoot Boss, pattern your shotgun to make more clean and ethical shots, reduce crippling, and remove lead from the uplands, wetlands, and all lands. Find out more at BossShotShells.com. A big shout out to the people and the partners that are helping me to keep the MP3s rolling for this podcast. My Patreon patrons, the bread and butter of the peeps, the community of like-minded individuals that are eager to learn and offer to contribute. Join us for $5 per month on patreon.com/thebirddogbabe for exclusive discounts, content, and live Q&A sessions. 5% of your contribution goes to the AKC Canine Health Foundation, and another 5% goes to conservation. Dakota 283, unparalleled protection for your dog's travel to and from your next adventure. My favorite is the G3 kennel, which has a recessed handle on top that makes it easy for me to lift in and out of my truck. The keyed panel latching door makes me feel at ease on trips when I have to leave dogs in my truck when I stop for fuel. An added bonus is the drain hole in the back, which makes cleaning a breeze when my dog has been run hard and put away wet. Go to Dakota283.com and use promo code BIRDDOGBABE for 10% off. And by Siren, shotguns for women. Siren carries the only full line of women's shotguns. They are dedicated to providing the equipment and knowledge that make shooting and hunting more enjoyable and less stressful. Newer seasoned hunter, Siren offers multiple options that fit right out of the box. No more compromises. Go to SirenUSA.com and check out all the options available for upland, waterfowl, sporting, and trap shotguns. And while you're there, say hello to Julia, Siren's new 12-gauge sporting that is one of the most stunning shotguns I've laid my eyes on. Also by Big Frig, roto-molded coolers with heavy-duty latches, dual stainless steel lock plates that double as bottle openers. They also have dry boxes, tumblers, and growlers, and my favorite, the ability to customize the tumblers and coolers. Head to thebirddogbabe.com/bigfrig to view the wide array of sizes and colors available. There's a Badlands cooler perfect for your way of life. I'm sure a lot of your clients were in Dubuque anyhow.
They were, and yeah, I mean, from a business standpoint, things really exploded when we came over here, and we started offering a dog day camp or daycare type of option where we do some enrichment programs with the dogs, and that has proven to be really popular. So in addition to the training, it's just really kind of grown the whole business model.
Mm-hmm. Are you guys doing a lot of board and train then?
Yeah, we had our right now we're booked out until I think the first week of April. So, and okay. You know, that's I think about eight a week we've got here generally. So,
okay. Well, that's a nice number.
Yeah, it is.
Do you have full-time trainers with you there? Mm-hmm. Okay. How many do you have?
I have two full-time trainers. And then, we have a staff of 12 people. So two full-time trainers. I have a general manager I hired a couple years ago just because I was on the road a lot. So I wanted somebody holding down the fort. And I got an office manager. And then the day camp manager has two assistants. And then we have several part-time people that work in the kennels and that just kind of serve as in assistant roles. You know, wherever we need them, they kind of float throughout the day.
Nice.
Yeah,
you got a great thing going there. Gosh, you've definitely grown a lot since since I've been there.
Yeah. No, I was trying to refresh my memory too because it was a long time ago, and yeah. I think you were in Platteville at the time, if I remember correctly. And did you have a setter?
Yes, Irish setter. Yes.
Okay. Yep.
Reagan.
Yep, yeah. Reagan. Yes.
Yes, and that's when Jake was working with you, and yes,
employee. Yes,
right. And I was trying to think of the year too. So, and it might help you. So you had Hero at the time, and I think you had just gotten Tommy.
So that would have been, I would say that had been 2004 when I just got Tom.
Okay.
Yeah. So. Yeah, that'd be probably about right. That'd be about right.
Okay. Let's kick it off. Like what, when people ask you what kind of dog trainer you are, how do you respond to that?
Oh gosh. A pretty good one. you know, primarily pet dog training. That's the bread and butter, and that's the vast majority of the work we do. And I think that people in the profession, can sometimes think, well, or even outside the profession, I think, you know, it's like, well, you get to play with puppies and nice dogs all day. And there's certainly a part of that, because a lot of it is just simple stuff like teaching the dog to walk on a leash and come when called. But the thing in the pet dog world is we see people get breeds, working breeds, breeds that aren't going to necessarily do particularly well in the urban environment that they're trying to raise them in, and with the lifestyle that they're trying to acclimate them to. And I learned that pretty early on, that people were sometimes in over their head because they were picking breeds that just really weren't well suited to just be a pet per se. And that's what started me expanding, you know, because I started to study then with retriever trainers, gun dog people, IPO people, did a lot of work in the protection groups for quite a long time, because not that I had high ambitions of competition, but I really wanted to understand, okay, if you can turn on aggressive behavior, then obviously you have to understand how to turn it off. And I wanted to understand a variety of breeds a lot better, because we see them all in the pet world. So I think that's what really kind of helped expand my reputation as a pet dog trainer, is that I just had a lot of understanding of a lot of these other venues within the dog training world. So while pet dog training has been the bread and butter, in the past, I did a lot of police canine, helping coach and worked with a lot of departments, a little bit of military involvement. I've done several service dogs for people. I do not by any stretch of the imagination do any competitive gun dog work at all, but I've helped, you know, the weekend hunters put a force fetch on their dog and things like that. So pretty broad range of experience in what I've done. And that's, I think, what has kept it so interesting for me to get to do all that stuff.
Mm-hmm. Right. And I think even with gun dog training, having that solid foundation and just knowing the basics and structure on that dog is like 90% of the rest of that gun dog's life and training anyhow.
Oh my gosh. Yeah. And you know, it's interesting, as a pet dog person, I've had people come in, years ago, had somebody come in with a heeler. And, you know, one of the things I always ask them is, well, what are your goals? What do you want to do? And they said, I want to hunt with them. And I, you know, it's hard not to giggle, because I'm like, well, why didn't you get a gun dog then? And what'd you get a herding breed for? Because, you know, starting with the right tools for your goals, it is so important. And understanding genetics and understand what you're getting, because why do you want to swim upstream all the time to try to create something that just isn't innately built into the dog to begin with? So,
right. Right. And I want to get into that too, a little deeper in here. You know, with vice versa of being, like you said, living in town, having a gun dog breed that is bred specifically, all the genetics aligned to have a lot of dog right there. And then, putting them in an environment where that never actually gets expressed. Mm-hmm. So I guess let's just do it. We're there. We're here right now. Okay. and I kind of wanted to play that into, because you have a Nova Scotia duck tolling retriever yourself, right?
I do. Yes.
Yeah. Yeah. And do you hunt yours?
I do not hunt with Diva. I have put, I've done, all of what you would say. I've done all the yard work. She has, she does blind retrieves. I have a fair amount of directional work that I've done with her. She's whistle trained. I have done those things with her, and I'm simply using, you know, retrieve dummies. For one simple reason, I'm not a hunter. You know, I've shot a gun a couple of times in my life, no opposition to it. It's just not something that, I have really, you know, pursued. So I have no real knowledge or expertise in that. She has a force fetch on her, not only with the retrieve dummies, but I mean, I do simple, silly things throughout the day to keep her busy, where I'll drop my pencil, you know, on the floor and make her pick it up, or bring me my slippers or something, just to keep her busy. Because getting the duck toller, I knew I had a dog that innately wanted to do something, and I was going to have to keep her mind and body busy. So I put her through all the paces. I did take her up to a friend of mine in Minnesota a couple years ago, and we put her on birds. And it was so much fun because I just stood back and I let him work her for a while. And he was able, because she had all the groundwork and she understood it, and he worked her and built a relationship for a few minutes and got him, you know, got her tuned into him. And she was, he was sending her out 150 yards on some blind retrieves. And it was just amazing. Once he introduced her to live birds, how quickly, you know, you could see, even though she loves what I do with her, you could see that light come on in her eyes, Courtney. She was like, oh, this is what I'm built for. I love this. Yeah. So I kind of feel a little remiss that I didn't pursue it a bit more for her sake, for her.
Sure.
Yeah.
Yeah. That's so interesting because you hear that from so many people. And I mean, even me personally, that's how and why I started to hunt was because my husband hunted and he would take my dog with him and I'd go out in the field because I enjoyed watching her work and taking photos. And then she started bringing the bird back to me, like saying, Mom, let's go hunt. Like, I want you to be shooting these for me. And so you do hear that story, Robin, like that experience you went through of, I saw how much my dog loved it and I wanted to give that to my dog. But it's you keep plenty busy with her in the meantime that, you know, to be able to do other things to fulfill that need for her. And I think that that's something to recognize for those people that do have these gun dog breeds, the sporting breeds, bird dog breeds, that they're able to find an outlet for them. Mm-hmm. And at the same time, I mean, what's your experience in working with those dogs in pet obedience and some issues you see that arise if they don't have that outlet?
Oh boy. You know, the issues, I mean, obviously a certain amount of destructiveness, just because there's so much pent up energy and frustration. Some of them, you know, you get some of the really drivey ones, become territorial. We'll see it kind of flip on those switches. Some inappropriate predatory aggression we'll see to start. I mean, the dog just has no outlet. And what it's my job to do is, first of all, help people realize what did you get this dog for? More often than not, they get them because of reputation. Oh, I heard Labs are a great dog. And obviously they are a great dog, but they might not have realized if you're purchasing from a good breeder who's got working line of dogs, you might be well in over your head. And if you're not going to provide him, as you said, some sort of fulfillment, you're going to all that drive, all that energy, all that intention is going to leak out one way or another. So either you can choose to adapt your life and find direction for that, or you're going to have a lot of frustration and your dog's going to have a lot of frustration. So my job is to get some obedience on there and say, okay, obedience can be part of this dog's job, but that's not going to be enough. Let's, you know, these natural retrievers, let's just shape this retrieve and start teaching them simple things. I mean, my office, my general manager, her dog hunts with her husband, but gets the paper for her and helps take in the groceries for her. And, you know, so we're finding jobs for the dogs. And that's what I try to help people do, is figure out, well, what can we fit within your lifestyle that's realistic, that this dog can get some sense of fulfillment doing what they, some similarity to what they naturally were meant to do. And that's the hardest process sometimes about being a pet dog trainer, is helping people understand your dog is not fulfilled sitting on the couch with you at night and taking a quick walk around the block, you know, in the morning. And it doesn't matter that he has a big yard and 30 toys. He is not fulfilled by that because he's built to do something else that has a purpose. So if you can't make him feel like he has a purpose, you know, I think any of us are going to go a little crazy if we don't have a purpose, and our dogs are going to express it in ways that are going to be very frustrating to us.
Right. And on that tone, I mean, I can exercise, I can run dogs off a four-wheeler for an hour. They can come back and they can be ready to go again as soon as we get back into the driveway, versus that 20-minute training session when they are just completely spent for the rest of the day after that mental exercise that they're getting. And yeah, a lot of the times we're, you know, we get inquiries from people wanting a puppy of, I don't hunt, but I'm active. I bike, I run. And I mean, what's your opinion there? Are those people going to be able to fulfill what these bird dogs needs just by physical exercise?
Just by physical exercise? No. I mean, I feel exactly the same way you do, Courtney. I think people, it's wonderful. And that's a really good start, because certainly there are people that do not provide enough physical exercise for their dogs. And that's sad. But what I make sure people understand is, if that's the only thing you're going to provide, what you're doing essentially is building a elite athlete that doesn't wear out. If you don't balance that with mental exercise that actually creates mental fatigue, you're going to have a dog that doesn't learn how to have that off switch and learn how to calm down, because you haven't provided that type of fulfillment for them. So we have to show them that other aspect as well.
Mm-hmm. I'm curious, in your experience with all the different breeds that you do train, I think right offhand of the herding breeds, the ones that genetically they're predisposed to kind of, you know, be doing that pushing. And a lot of times you'll hear people, breeders of herding dogs, say, I won't sell to families that have kids in them, because or else they're gonna be biting at the kids. Mm-hmm. What's your experience with that?
I wish more breeders would say that. And that might not sound popular if you've got, you know, listeners that are in that situation, and they think, well, that's just a breed I've always wanted. And, you know, my kids are 4 years old, and I think I've heard that it's an active dog, and we want an active dog, and sounds like it'd be good for the family. And the answer is no. I mean, I wish people would ask those questions before they had the dog, because once they do, then obviously I've got to find a workaround and start to fix those things. And we do, and we have good success, but it can be an uphill battle. I wish more breeders would be a bit more straightforward and say, this is not the right fit for you, at least not at this time in your life. You know, maybe you can look at this breed or this breed or this breed. That dog is going to push, and they're going to push children. And can you work with them and teach them to have more respect? Yeah, you can. But the reality is, I think most of our households are pretty busy nowadays, and just training a puppy that's relatively easy takes time, much less training a dog, with a strong personality that's going to do some of those things that are going to be against your house rules. So again, I'm very much an advocate that people should try to have a vision. What do I want a dog for? What is my vision 2 years down the road of what the life is going to be like for me and my dog? Once you know that, it's a lot easier to start to pick the breed, or even if you're going to get a mix, the mix of breed that is correct for you, rather than looking at a dog and say, gosh, he's cute, and my friend Joe sure had good luck with that breed, so therefore it must be the right one for me. That's the wrong way to go about picking out a companion that's going to be with you for 10 to 15 years.
Mm-hmm. I agree. What do you think is the biggest struggle that people have most when they are working with their dogs? Like the communication between the owner and the dog, where are you seeing the struggle there?
Well, I would say that probably the fundamental problem is people don't understand dogs. There's so much anthropomorphizing that, and they attribute so much human behavior and human emotion and human thought process to an entirely different species. And that's where they get into trouble. And once you go down that road, you make a lot of really common mistakes. So I think that's the number one thing, is that they attribute human behavior to a dog, and what they need to do is actually understand dog behavior, do a little research and a little reading and understand it better. And then they need to understand and really evaluate, when you're thinking about getting a dog, do I honestly have time for this? Because just like any relationship, it takes time. This dog does not come into your home understanding what your house rules are and understanding how to communicate with you. You have to learn how to communicate with them, and you have to put in a consistent amount of effort on a daily basis. And I try to help people to understand that doesn't mean that it's going to be completely overwhelming. I'm not saying you have to do 20-minute sessions 3 times a day. Certainly, that's wonderful if you can. But you have to put in some time, and you definitely have to learn that this is the lifestyle for the dog. This is not something where, you know, I think a lot of people say, how long is it going to take to train the dog? And that's a mistake in thinking to begin with, because there's not an end point. You know, you can get some basic foundation, but this is going to be a lifestyle. And if this isn't going to be something you can incorporate into a daily routine with your dog for here until the day they leave, then you probably don't want to go down that path because you'll have problems.
And I mean, is there a way for us to better understand, to better read our dogs and build that relationship with them where it's more of a partnership instead of a pet?
I think, you know, and that's an interesting question, Courtney, and I might flip the question back to you and see what your thoughts are, because this is interesting. But yeah. I do think that some of it starts out, one of the things you said earlier is you said, you know, your husband took your dog hunting and you were taking photographs and you liked the observation and you watched and saw your dog kind of light up when the dog was doing those jobs. I think a lot of it can be aided by observation. Stand back for a minute. Stop telling your dog what to do immediately. Stop trying to influence them immediately and watch your dog and observe what does influence them. You know, one of the things I like to do when I get a puppy is just put them on a long line and let them explore and see how they react to things. See how influenced they are by their nose. See what catches their sight. You know, when you start to understand how a dog uses their senses, to interpret the world around them, then you can start to use some of those same techniques to influence them. You know, like one simple thing I tell people, okay, because everybody wants their dog to come to them, but people are moving toward their dog in order to get the dog to come to them. And what they're doing is pushing the dog away from them. The dog keeps playing keep away. If you watch a dog, what gets a dog to go after something? They chase everything, right? They like movement that's going away. They chase squirrels, they'll chase the bike, they'll chase the rabbit. If you want your dog to come to you, move away from it. You know, jog backwards, walk away from the dog. Bend down can help. But if they understand what naturally inspires the dog's behavior, then they can start to emulate some of that and use it to their advantage. So I think observation is a starting point for people to understand how to communicate with a dog.
Put yourself in the dog's head. Like I look at, like right now we're doing a retrieving class, and you know, the concept of when they're puppies, when they're grabbing naughty things in the house and we're chasing after them, pulling it out of their mouth and telling them no, or when they run away, they run out of the yard, you're calling them to come back. And then you're so upset when they get back to you that you're yelling at them, you know, so put yourself in the dog's, on the dog's side, right? Where they're like, oh, when I have something, they just chase me down and want to rip it from me. Or when I come back, I'm scolded when I finally come back to you. So I think there's a lot of miscommunication there when we're putting our emotions of the situation instead of saying, oh, good girl, you finally came home to me. I'm so excited to see you.
Exactly. Yeah. You're 100% right about that. And I've seen recently, we've had several cases of resource guarding, and people will say, well, you know, I tried to prove to him I was alpha. And I say, well, what exactly does that mean? What were you doing? Well, as soon as he started to growl, I reached down and I took his food bowl away from him, you know, and I scolded him. And I said, so you proved to him that you are a thief and you can't be trusted.
Yeah.
And they're like, oh, I guess I didn't think of it that way. And I said, well, you know, how do you feel if you have $100 bill in your hand and a stranger starts to walk up, or even if they're a reasonably good friend, they walk up and snatch it out of your hand. You know, any of us, survival instinct makes us guard resources. The goal is to teach your dog you are a trusted person and you will trade, you will give more, you will provide, not that you're a thief that's there to take everything. But, you know, and I think that is it. You're explaining things to your clients. I'm explaining them to mine. You got to try to step into that dog's fur for a minute and try to understand how do they see this. And that can really help solve a whole lot of problems.
So I'm curious what your insight is there when you talked about the alpha, because some trainers I've talked to are, you know, really into you have to be the alpha with a dog, and the other ones are against that. And what's your mentality on that perspective?
You know, I think I think the word has just gotten so, like, I try not to touch that word too much anymore, because it's so, I don't know, what's the word that I want? I'm lacking for the adjective.
I don't know. There's a lot of stigma around it.
There's a lot of stigma around it, you know, and because it's been used oftentimes to mean very aggressive handling, right? You know, rolling them over, the alpha roll, the scruff grab, that type of thing is associated with I must be the alpha. But I know people certainly that use the word alpha and they simply mean leadership. You need to be the good leader. And I personally believe, yes, absolutely, dogs need leadership. Dogs gravitate toward leadership. Dogs like clarity. Dogs respond very well to good leadership. But the thing about leadership is, and I think this goes pretty much for any of us, we gravitate toward leaders that are calm and clear, not leaders that are angry and erratic. So we have to understand, how can you be that calm and clear leader? Whether you want to call that alpha or not, I think that's, you know, that's where we get into semantics. I try not to use the word, but I do think we have to help people understand, how can you be a good leader for your dog, and how can you show them, teach them what's expected? And then there comes a point where we hold dogs accountable. But if you understand how to manipulate behavior to begin with, you know, I'd say it's rare to never that you have to be really kind of aggressive. I wouldn't say never, but it's pretty rare that you have to be particularly strong with the dog. So most of the time, you know, if you've laid the foundation, that leadership, you create that willing partnership in the dog that wants to work for you.
What in your opinion is the toughest issue to conquer with dogs? Is it aggression or being too timid?
Well, I guess when you ask me that question, I think, well, what's the most difficult for an owner versus what's the most difficult for me? Because I find it much easier. That's just my personality. I find it much easier to work with and handle a dog that is a lot of dog, a dog that might be, you know, that might take offense to that's got a strong personality, that might take a little bit of offense to me pushing. I like strong personality, so I work well with them, and taking just enough air out of the tires to make them manageable for me. I enjoy that. That's a dog that's going to learn very quickly, very fast. We work together very well. To pump up a dog that is really shut down, really closed off, to me, they're harder, only because it's a very slow process. You know, you can only go as fast as the dog is willing to go. So you really have to work on yourself. I tend to be a very active, action-oriented person anyway. I'm a busybody. So for me to work a dog where I really have to slow myself down, really have to collect myself, really be very, very patient and wait for the dog to trust me and build that relationship, those are harder for me, just because the pace has to slow down tremendously. For instance, right now we have a dog in that we've been working with, and I would assume she came from a shelter, but she was shipped up from down south. I would assume she was feral. At the very least, she was a stray. And she's just so shut down. There's been absolutely zero indication that she would try to fear bite us. She will just literally curl herself into a ball and shut down. Mm-hmm. Her whole repertoire is flight behavior. And so building her up and building some confidence, you know, this morning I did some body massage with her, and I was using some essential oils and stuff, and that kind of got her to relax. And then I started doing a little confidence work where I was having her kind of jump up on different platforms. And that started to make her shine a little bit. You know, she got just a little bit of a sparkle in her eye. I want her to learn you can do this. Those are harder because the process is so much slower than the dog that's, you know, pinging off the walls, and you just got to slow them down for a second and say, okay, you can focus. Let's have you jump up here and sit still for a minute. So for me, that's, you know, that's the way that I look at it. The average pet owner probably struggles more with the pinging off the wall dog because they're frantic in trying to stop them, and they're more tolerant of the shutdown dog because that dog isn't causing any problem to begin with. He's just laying in the corner. So it's interesting that it's kind of a flip dynamic in how I look at it, or what I prefer to work with, as opposed to what people would prefer to tolerate and deal with. So right.
Do you find that you change your approach with those dogs in terms of maybe with the stronger willed dogs, you're coming in more, I don't know what the word would be, not confident, but just more level when you talk, versus with a dog that you need to build up where you change your voice, you're talking a little bit higher pitched, giving them encouragement? Or do you find yourself just coming in the same way every time, with no matter what kind of dog you're working with?
No, I would, it's very tailored. It definitely is tailored. You know, with this dog I was just referring to, this dog that I would say is probably feral, my body language is dramatically different because I want her to feel comfortable with me, but not the least bit intimidated or threatened by me at all. I don't want her to see me as confrontational in any respect. So when I approach her, I don't even go up frontal. I go, you know, I back into her. Because it's perceived by her as way less threatening. So I back into her. I always have myself kind of bladed or to the side. If I reach out to her, I come from the side. I never go like over her head or toward her nose or anything like that. Because for her, that is way too confrontational. And she just crushes, you know, into a little ball. Versus the dog that is just pinging off the walls and jumping all over me and really exuberant, I'm going to stand more upright. I'm going to be directly in front of them because I do want to have a presence with that particular dog that, hey, back off. I would step into that dog if he was jumping on me, because then he's going to have to learn to yield body space to me because he's infringing on my space. Versus this other dog, I'm basically yielding space to her to say, hey, I'm not going to encroach. I'm going to let you get comfortable with things. Let's see if you'll come in here to me. And so it's a more of an invitation. So yeah, the approach has to be tailored to the dog that I'm working with.
What about for the aggressive dogs? What's your approach look like with them?
Well, it depends on what it depends on what I believe the root of the aggressive behavior is. Is this a dog that bites me because he thinks he has to, because he feels defensive? Or is this a dog that would bite me because he thinks he can? Those are two very different fundamental reasons for why. And those are really the only reasons that a dog's going to bite. Either they think they can or they think they have to. So if they think they have to, it's coming from a foundation of fear and insecurity. Then I'm going to use more of the techniques that I described with the feral dog, and I'm going to put that dog more at ease. I don't want to push him over any threshold. I want him to realize that he can trust me. If it's a dog that thinks he can, and I do want to point out for anybody listening that those are far and few between. They really are. They're far and few between, but they are out there. Those are not dogs that are typically barking, lunging, making noise. They are very, very quiet as a general rule. They're very confident. They're very forward in their body posture. Those dogs, I will be a lot more, I will certainly be more upright. I'm not putting my face down by those guys typically. I will, though, come in a bit more from the side, because if I go in too strong right off the bat, then I'm producing conflict in that dog, and he may say, well, I'll take your bet and I'll raise you. So I have to build a relationship with those dogs that proves to him I'm a capable leader. And then I have to work with him to say, but you do have to do things my way. So that's a delicate balance, because again, if that dog really is a strong personality and believes that he's fully entitled to bite me and show, you know, push me back, then I don't want to be, because you got to remember, I'm working with somebody else's dog. This isn't necessarily a dog I'm going to live with. I don't want to be practicing that behavior. So I have to build mutually respectful relationship with him and teach him how to want to work with me. And that's always a very interesting process too. A lot of that is about reward manipulation. I had to figure out what he likes and show him you'll get what you like by doing things my way. And fortunately, when we live with a dog, we can manipulate most every resource that they have, you know, their access to food, affection, toys, space. And so I have to teach people how to utilize those things in order to safely live with a dog like that.
So with your experience and knowledge of reading dogs, I'm curious your insight on some situations here. So a lot of my listeners are people that compete with their dogs or have them at venues where there's testing and trialing. And some of them are when they run embraces with another dog. And so I look at the ones that have the novice, the younger dogs that on their very first time at a hunt test, they'll find out who they're braced with and they'll say, "Can let's have our dogs meet before they go on the field together." So they walk up these two dogs face to face, and that sometimes goes well. It sometimes doesn't go well. Or if during the brace, something happens and one gets attacked. So a couple things here. So what would be the proper way to introduce or just completely avoid the situation of going face to face on lead versus letting them go off leash in the field? How should dogs meet or just avoid that and let them do it on their own off lead?
It's a big question.
Yeah.
And my first thought, and I can't say I feel 100% confident in this because I haven't gone to an event and witnessed how it's all, you know, how all this is unfolding. But my first thought is that would be a bad place to introduce two strange dogs, because I'm going to guess they know they're at a trial. There's a certain level of excitement anyway, an adrenaline rush in that environment. Mm-hmm. So they're already in an elevated state of mind. And now being on leash is a dicey way to introduce dogs because, you know, there's a fight or flight response generally. And if you take away one option, because we're tethered to a leash, then if the dogs are going to have any kind of conflict, you've only left the option of fight. So on leash can be a pretty dicey experience. Certainly frontal approach, I have a problem with. When we are working with aggressive dogs here, when we acclimate, we generally, if I have two handlers, two dogs, we come in from a Y. If you picture the far ends of the Y, we come in from those two points and we're walking, and then we kind of meet at that intersection of the Y and we don't stop. We just keep walking. So the dogs are following their leaders, being the humans, and getting in proximity and getting exposure to one another in a more controlled circumstance. And that way we can kind of evaluate, how do these dogs appear to be behaving? Are they focused on us? Are they taking in, you know, are they air sensing each other, getting a little bit of a feel for each other? If we think that it's going to go well, then obviously we're going to loosen. A lot of times we do this on a longer line rather than a 5 or 6 foot lead, then we can let out some slack and we can, you know, give them 2 to 3 seconds of opportunity to sniff, and then they have to move away. We part them simply by saying, "Let's go." At that point, the dogs have a good amount of obedience. So we don't let them do the extended sniff, because extended sniffing can be like an extended handshake. It can be very rude and it can cause a problem. So we move them off from each other. And then if it's going well, again, we do a reintroduction and we can continue to build the relationship between the two of them that way. Eventually, we like to run them off leash. But again, I personally wouldn't think that at a venue like that would be the way to do it. My thought process in the situation you guys would be facing is, if I'm taking my dog to a hunt test and to a trial, his job is to stay dedicated to task. I would be training my dog that it really doesn't matter what's going on around you, whether it's another dog or whatever, you need to be dedicated to the task you're trained to do. So I think in that situation, it's more about impulse control. Now, if somebody else's dog starts it when they're out, you know, in the competition, then your dog's going to defend himself and that's going to be really unfortunate. But I guess that's just the way that I'm thinking about that. I would probably approach something like that.
Yep. And I agree with that. So what if you have the dog that has just been rolled by the bracemate or attacked by the bracemate, what is the best thing to do and how we respond to our dog just being attacked that is going to help their confidence moving forward? Do we go down and say, are you okay, and coddle them, and or do we just say, let's go, carry on?
Yeah, it's, you know, assuming that the dog didn't suffer any significant injury. Yeah, it's right. Pick them up. You know, it's like a kid falling off the bike. Pick them up and move on. Let's go. Let's do it again. You know, I would be wanting to get that dog back into some retrieving and back into exactly what takes his mind off of the event that just happened. You do not want to lock your dog into a traumatic event.
What about putting them with another dog soon after that in a, you know, in a, that you know the other dog will be okay? Does that make any difference?
Okay. I think so. Absolutely. Getting them around dogs that are social and capable and trying to repeat those events done properly, I think that's very helpful.
Okay. Where do you think aggression normally stems from? I mean, do you have the thought that that's something dogs are born with, or do you think that is something that has happened in their environment?
Oh, that's a big question too. Well, you know, I would say there's definitely some where you see genetics is an influence. There are those occasions where there's poor breeding and there's something in the line. And certainly we've seen that in certain, you know, you can remember years ago when there was such a problem with Springers. So you can see that. But I think more often than not, dogs would prefer to avoid conflict, especially serious conflict. You know, there might be in a group of dogs, there might be a little jockeying for space. There might be a reprimand that happens, that kind of thing. But serious conflict is generally something that dogs want to avoid. I think that in the world we're living in with our dogs, more often than not, it becomes a learned behavior because the human that owns the dog unintentionally built that behavior up. You know, a lot of times it does happen by, you know, people think, they get a new puppy and they think, okay, I have to socialize my puppy. They know that phrase, I have to socialize my puppy. But they don't really know what it means. And so they take the dog, that puppy on leash, and they take them to a rather chaotic environment. I've seen people go to like our local farmer's market with, you know, 8 and 10 week old puppies, and they're dragging them around on a leash in this environment. And they're insisting, you know, oh, well, come up and pet the dog. And they're letting other dogs come up and, in my opinion, bully, even though it may be playful behavior. You take a 10-week-old puppy and put him up with a 7-month-old puppy, and he's being bullied and, you know, jockeyed around like that. That's a setup for problems down the road. So I think a lot of times the dogs have learned to become, they become, they're defensive in the beginning, and they go on to offense eventually because they've been put into so many situations where essentially the owner was not advocating for the best interest of the dog. They thought they were, but they were making some real classic mistakes.
Mm-hmm. That's a good point of going with proper socialization as a puppy, because I think that is a very, very loose term that we use. I wanted to get in a little bit about the use of remote collar training. And I think I'm incredibly fortunate to have been introduced to that by you, who I think is like the top person to help people understand remote collars in the entire world. And well, and how fortunate was I, you know, to go to college and have you just 15 minutes away, not knowing, you know, really the path that you and your knowledge was going to set me on. But the way you did it, Robin, and I still remember the very first day we had a consultation, and you had talked about the remote training at that time, which I had never done before. And you said, here, you put it on my hand and you said, feel it. And I, like, everything in my body, it made me feel like I was shooting a shotgun for the first time, like eyes clenching, just nervous, like, oh no, don't hit it. Because, you know, of what we think it's going to be, right? You're going to do something, it's going to shock me. And I'm already like deathly afraid of electric fences the right. way it is. So that's how it was going down in my head. And then you did it. And I looked at you and I'm like, that was it? And you go, yeah. and I said, is this what my dog's going to feel? And you go, yes. And I go, turn it up. And then you turn it up a little bit here and there. And then it was incredibly useful. And I think people miss that step. It's an important step of knowing how it feels to our dog. And I think with that too, there's just a lot of improper use of the remote collars. And I mean, what are you finding that the average person is doing wrong with remote collar training?
Well, I think when a person doesn't get some help and understand how to do collar conditioning with a dog, the problem they have is they make an assumption. And the assumption is my dog knows. My dog knows he's supposed to come, or my dog knows he shouldn't, you know, bolt the door, or my dog knows he shouldn't jump on the counter. And therefore, because I have struggled to convince him to not do those things anymore, I am going to get the biggest hammer in the box, which they assume is the remote collar. And I'm going to prove to him once and for all that that is a behavior that will be punished. And that's the mistake that people make. And that is the mistake that causes remote collars to get a reputation as a shock collar and as a evil or cruel tool. You know, and it's so unfair. Not only is it incredibly unfortunate because it's a very useful tool, but it's so unfair because they're blaming a piece of equipment that they purchased, put on the dog, and used. They're the ones that push the button. It is not the collar's fault that they didn't take time to actually figure out, how do I use this thing? You know, if I went and purchased a bunch of lovely, expensive tools from the auto parts store, and I started tinkering with the engine of my car, no one would blame the auto parts store or the tools for my lack of competence. They would say, well, are you an idiot? What do you think you're doing, Robin? You don't know anything about the mechanics of a car or how to fix that kind of stuff. And so that's where people get into problems, is they think that they, you know, the dog understands, and therefore if I just use this higher level of punishment, so to speak, then he'll stop. And when they get a bad response and they get an outcome that they were not expecting because they used it so improperly, they blame the tool. And that's where I became so passionate about trying to help people understand, well, the tool is great, you just need some knowledge of understanding how you use that. And teaching people that you have to do a collar conditioning process to teach the dog how do you respond to tactile cueing system or tactile stimulation. And that's really, you know, what I try to help people understand, is you're using a tactile communication system to communicate with the dog. And that's the huge advantage of that. I mean, we both know that, is once the dog understands it, you can then use that system when they're off leash and essentially have a way to communicate with them at a distance that you previously couldn't, you know, you couldn't achieve when you were trying to do things just on long lines and off leash.
Mm-hmm. And I don't want to get, you know, into, at least today, the, you know, the use and how to do that with conditioning of teaching a dog to do it or having the owner do it. And I think you have some incredible resources that we can direct them to help learn that. You have DVDs. Mm-hmm. It's like a step-by-step guide to remote collar training. Where can people find those at?
Well, and actually, yes, I did my first DVD in 2008, and I still have that available. But to be honest with you, if people want to get the most recent and complete visual and look at my work, they should go to Gun Dog Supply.
Okay.
My friends down there, Steve and Rob Snell, have been we've been working together for a few years, and they helped me put together an incredible five disc CD set, DVD set. And so it's available only through Gun Dog Supply. So they can go there and they can search my name or just, you know, look for DVDs on their site. And that is a really nice volume, because what we did, it was such a cool project. We took three dogs out of shelters. So they were dogs that I did not know. They didn't have any previous training. They were completely green dogs, different personalities. So you see three different dogs of three different personalities. And we filmed for 3 weeks. I just trained these dogs every single day. And we filmed for 3 weeks. And we did not do any fancy editing to this thing. And you really just get to see different approaches and how I dealt with those different dogs. So basically the goal was to take your dog from the very beginning to being off leash reliable. And so that I think is really the best piece of work to date that I have out there on the market that I'm really proud of.
That sounds incredible. And I wish that those were required with every single sale of an e-collar.
Right.
Yeah. And I have seen those there, and I know, like they even have bundles with e-collars, I think, with your DVDs.
Yeah, they do. They put a starter DVD in all their e-collar sales. Yeah.
Yeah. That's fantastic.
Yeah. They're very committed to education, and I love working
with them. That's what it's about.
Yeah. Right. Great group of people.
So with e-collars, we have the options of Nick, Continuous, Tone, and Vibrate. Mm-hmm. Can you maybe explain when we would use each of those different options, or do you not use some of those?
I have used all of them. It depends. And honestly, the answer is it depends. It does depend on the dog, because I don't always do the same thing with every single dog. I do make sure every dog is acclimated to stimulation. I am not a person that says, well, you're just going to train with vibration. The thing about vibration is it's not particularly variable. Some dogs are actually so, and I did demonstrate that in my very first DVD, is we used the vibration button and the dog freaked out. I mean, he jumped and he kind of yiped. It just startled him. And so that's the challenge sometimes with vibration, is you can't even actually go low enough to, you know, use it in a fair way with the dog. So you have to figure out what's going to work for the dog. But I have found vibration to be particularly useful. A lot of times with a deaf dog, I will teach it as a single cue, which is look at me. So when you feel vibration, look at me. If I can get the dog to look at me, then I can start teaching them hand signals for recall or sit or whatever I'm working on. I've also had a fair number of people in the police canine world who we've used the pager as a silent recall. So if they're doing a building search or something like that, and the handler doesn't want to disclose his location, then he can use the paging feature, the vibration feature, to have the dog come back to him. So those are kind of some specialized uses. Some dogs will use vibration like for whining and things like that. It can work well as an interrupter. It just depends on the dog. Same thing with the tone. Some people like to use tone as a warning signal. I personally don't train that way, where they'll basically, it's, you know, the tone means if you don't comply, then I'm going to use stimulation. I don't train that way. If I were to use tone again, it's generally going to be with a certain cue. It might mean to recall, or it might mean to sit, or something like that. It just depends on what the handler might want from that. As far as the momentary and the continuous stimulation, they can be interchangeable. It just depends, again, on the dog. I have found continuous to be particularly effective for instance, in my pet world, you get people that get hounds and that kind of thing, and their nose is just glued to the ground on some scent. And they might be using the Nick button to kind of recall the dog, and it's just not breaking through because the dog is so distracted. Where if you're using a continual pulse, it doesn't feel stronger to the dog, but because the sensation, the duration of it is longer, that will break through, you know, the dog's focus when his nose is stuck to the ground or that kind of thing. So it just depends. I mean, honestly, it's so versatile. And I think that's the thing it's obviously the thing I love the most about a remote collar. It's so versatile. And when you really start getting into it and you start working different dogs on a remote, you just find that what works for one dog doesn't necessarily work for the next, and you start to adapt the techniques a little bit. So it just depends on the dog. But I think for anybody that hasn't used a remote collar, is you have to play with it a little bit. You know, it's interesting, Courtney, when I first started playing around with learning remote collars, I wanted to make sure that my timing was going to be pretty decent before I started working with my dog. And so I actually strapped it on my leg and I watched a television show, and I can't remember what word I picked. It was a common word, if it was and or but or something like that. But I just thought, every time I hear that word on TV, I'm going to push the button, because I wanted to try to develop some coordination between what I was hearing in the case of the TV show and pushing the button. You could do that with a visual, because obviously when you're working with your dog, you're watching for body language signals and that kind of thing. But I just wanted to start to develop some hand-eye coordination like that, so that I wasn't looking at my equipment and I was paying attention to the object of my attention and developing that hand coordination with it, because people are not comfortable when they first start using the remote and their eyes are glued to the remote rather than having their eyes glued to the dog. So I think it's practical to practice, find a way to practice a little bit before you start right away with your dog.
I like what you said there previously with the tone before a nick, because it reminds me with kids of giving them a countdown before they have to go into a timeout.
Yeah, because like, you start negotiating, right?
Right.
When I get to three and suddenly you're at 2.5, 2.75.
Yeah, because then they're still doing the behavior, and it's like, oh, if they stop now, you know, if they get the countdown, then no, you did something wrong. Yes. You're going to the corner.
Exactly. Yep.
I found so much how training dogs has been beneficial with same concepts of with the kids. It's
there's a lot of similarity.
There is. And with the collar training, I mean, my poor mom, I'm going to pick on her right now, but I know this is super common, of the dogs knowing when they have the collar on and off. And if they're naughty, you know, I'm going to go get that collar now and put it on him. And I'm not actually going to turn it on, but it's going to be on him and he's going to know he needs to behave. Mm-hmm. So are you seeing that often too, of just the dogs knowing I only need to behave when I have this collar on? And are you suggesting that the collar is worn all day, only in training situations? What's your thought on that?
Well, we do see it. It's not a desirable outcome. It's not my goal for my clients. It's certainly not my goal for my dogs. You know, I want my dogs, and I want to try to teach my clients that the enforcement is about you. It's about listening to you, not a piece of equipment. And so one thing I tell, you know, when I'm teaching somebody, I say, look, if you start something without the e-collar, finish it without the e-collar. So for instance, let's say you let the dog out the door and you call him to come and he doesn't come. Don't walk back into the kitchen and pick up your remote. I want you to walk out the door and go get your dog, because I don't want your dog to realize, oh, I only have to listen when they push the button, or I only have to listen when we put the collar on. So I want people to diversify how they enforce things with their dog. And the e-collar can be part of that. Certainly having the e-collar on throughout the day makes it easier to enforce things with the dog. If somebody comes to the door unexpectedly, it's easier to have the dog stay on his place rather than having to use his leash and move him back there. You can use your remote collar or your invisible leash to enforce things. But again, if you don't have it on, don't go running for it. All that said, even though that's my goal, some people don't have the time or don't want to put in the time to train to that level of reliability. You know, ultimately it is their dog. And I do have some people say, you know, he listens pretty well most of the time, but sometimes I have to put it on, like if we're going to have company, and I just have to, you know, have it for those times. If the dog's a little collar wise, but that fits their lifestyle, then I'm not going to argue about that. Again, it's not my goal for my dogs, but I'm not going to argue about it. What matters most to me in my pet training world is that they have a dog that they are happy with, that they give a fulfilled life, and that stays in the home for the duration of its life. You know, all of this started for me a long time ago because I was working as a vet tech, seeing people having to relinquish dogs and euthanize dogs because the relationship wasn't working out. So ultimately, I try not to judge if they do have a dog that's collar wise. If they're happy with that outcome, then I'm going to be happy for them that they're happy with their dog. And it's as simple as that.
Right. Do you think that there's a type of dog that shouldn't be trained with a remote collar? Like maybe the dog that you mentioned earlier that you're working with, if they're really soft or sensitive, if there's some fears, or do you think there's always a positive way to be able to incorporate that?
I do think there's always a positive way. I absolutely do. And with this particular dog that I was telling you about, we are using a collar to work on a recall. Because she has such a flight response, I think it's a safety feature for her. We want to at least build a reliable recall with her. So it still has a place. And we use a ton of food. You know, we'll load that thing basically like loading a clicker for a lot of dogs. So I think it has a place. It's just having an understanding of how to incorporate the collar into these different dogs' training. And actually, I find that the e-collar to be very useful with shy or anxious or sensitive dogs because I can use such low levels that I can be more subtle in my form of communication than I might be able to be with just a leash. And also because the ability from the dog's standpoint, from the dog's viewpoint, the sensation's always the same. So whether I'm operating the remote or one of my trainers is operating the remote or the client is operating the remote, from the dog's perspective, we're always communicating in exactly the same fashion. And for a shy or anxious dog, that consistency is actually very helpful for them.
That's really interesting. And yeah, it's an approach that I've seen used with a lot of dogs, and it is amazing how well they respond to it. Even when you think my dog's too soft for this, because it's like you said earlier, it's knowing how to use it and using it properly and not as a punishment. Well, thanks, Robin. I know I took up a lot of your time this morning, but it was super awesome to be able to catch up with you and get your insight on some of these questions and issues that people are having. But I think the biggest thing is to know how to use tools before you just put them on a dog, and everything else comes with instructions, but these don't in the manner that they should. So services that you're offering through That's My Dog, what are you all offering?
We offer board and train, private lessons. We have a puppy preschool, which actually I'm real excited. In the next month or two, that should be virtual and available to anybody that's interested in our preschool program, which really goes through this whole idea of socializing your dog properly and that kind of stuff. So that's pretty exciting. We do a little bit of boarding, and we do our day camp. And of course, I do a fair amount of, well, COVID shut everything down, but I do a fair amount of workshops and writing. When things open up again, hopefully I'll be back on the road doing some workshops and stuff. So.
Excellent. And Jordan Horick had actually mentioned to me that you did some help with him coming out with the Kato boards.
Yeah. Those are great. That's a great tool. And he is such an awesome person. Yes. Yeah. Really. Of that product.
Yeah, they're fantastic. And that's something that you, when I started training with you, that was like one of the very first commands I think that you had the dogs learn was a place command.
Oh yeah.
Do you think that that's the most important?
Oh, one of the most? That is like absolutely critical skill for any kind of advanced training, any of the stuff that you guys are doing. It's absolutely critical skill. For my pets, most of the time, it's just a spot to go lay down and chill. But, you know, if the dog understands that, you can stop the dog bolting the door. You can open the door for the pizza guy. For everything you guys do and for the protection work and all of that that I did in the past, you know, having that place command and understanding how to send the do send aways to a target oh my gosh, you can just build everything off of that.
Yeah. We've been utilizing them for probably like the past, 9 months. I mean, there's always been the place aspect, but having his boards as that actual tool and something that all of our owners and clients can, readily have available to get has been super helpful. And when he had mentioned
that, his boards are fantastic. They really are. Yeah. Absolutely. That is my favorite. That's my favorite. Yeah.
Do you prefer, which surface do you prefer when you're doing training?
It depends. If I'm inside, I like the rubber. If I'm outside, I like the carpet, the outdoor carpet type of stuff. Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
All right. Cool. Well, Robin, tell us how we can find you and connect with you.
Well, if people want to buy my DVDs, those are on Gundog Supply. If they want to reach out to me, I've got two websites. The company here in Dubuque is That's My Dog. So it's thatsmydog.com. And my personal website, is just Robin McFarlane, MacFarlane.com. And they can always reach me there too.
Perfect. Thanks so much, Robin. I really appreciate you coming on and sharing all your insight and knowledge with us.
It was really fun to catch up. Thanks, Courtney.
Thanks for listening to another episode of the Bird Dog Babe podcast. If you enjoyed this episode, share it and tag me and someone that would benefit from listening. Please help me out by giving the podcast a rating and review on whichever platform you're listening from, and hit subscribe so you don't miss an episode. Be sure to join me on Instagram, Facebook, and YouTube. And if you're interested in some Bird Dog Babe swag or gear that I rely on, be sure to check out the store on thebirddogbabe.com. And most importantly, don't forget to support the organizations that are working hard to conserve the birds you're chasing after and the public lands in which you hunt.